me to do something that's kind of ambitious, so I'll probably fall short in the time allotted, but to talk both generally about a conceptual framework of the use of medications and to talk about pharmacotherapy for alcohol use disorders. That's probably more than I should have bit off, but I'll give it a try. So this is what I'm going to try to hit. First of all, just a general framework for the use of medications. And because you're in the room, I suppose I don't have to convince you that there's some rationale for the use of medications. But perhaps the conversation will arm people a little bit with how to translate that to educate and convince other important stakeholders, whether those are administrators or providers, physicians, or patients. But I think it's important to be able to have the conversation in a way that's digestible for people who are not necessarily consumers of meta-analytic analyses, which aren't necessarily going to be what your patients are reading or what your physicians and nurses are reading. I'll talk a little bit about a background of the biological underpinnings. We won't go into a lot of neuroscience, but just to give everybody just a little reminder of what some of the possible mechanisms of these medicines are broadly, and that'll in some way set up Robert when he talks more particularly about opioid medications later in the day. I'll do an overview briefly of the current medications that we are using, in particular for alcohol use disorders, and again, Robert will talk about opioids later. And then if we have time, I'll give you a quick science fiction view into what the next generation of medications in the pipeline might be. Dennis mentioned that it's just as much about what's next as it is about what's now, because we're hoping we're going to get better and better and better. Not necessarily that we'll get the penicillin for addiction, maybe not in our lifetime, but just to talk about what could be coming. And then if we have some time to ask questions. By the way, it's a small enough group, so I'll keep going until you guys interrupt me, but please ask questions and interrupt as I go along. So here's just a cartoon picture of a historical perspective. This is from the 1890s, the patent medicines of that day. This is Winslow's soothing syrup, just to make the point that we think we're on the right track. I think we're on the right track. I hope to persuade you, and Dennis will try to persuade you, Robert later will try to persuade you we're on the right track. But we do need to be cautious. Everybody remember what was in Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup back in the 1890s?
Okay.
And
opium
and alcohol, right? So it was a winning combination, and no wonder a generation of little old ladies on the prairie were in trouble. I don't think that's where we're going, but we have to answer people, right? Part of the conversation is when people say, hey, you're just recreating the mistakes of the past. You've heard that you're substituting one addiction with another. Isn't methadone just another bandit? We have to be able to respond to that, whether we agree or not. Here's another cartoon. And if you like comfort food, I would recommend the Xanax stuffed pork loin. So, whereas part of our approach is that we want to give people lots of different options, right? We want to be, address patients with the notion that not every approach is right for every patient and there's a menu. There are limits to what's on the menu, right? And so we have to come with informed advice to folks about what's safe, what's not. Let's see if I can make this happen. I'm not great with video. If I do it, no? Who knows how to turn this on?
Maybe it's not going to transmit from the Mac.
I'll just keep moving. So let's go with a little biology and a conceptual framework as an introduction to the overall concept of the use of medications in addiction treatment broadly. So when people ask, what's the idea of medications for addiction? How does that make sense? Are they asking a philosophical question? Are they asking a scientific question? Are they asking a practical question? And if this were any other subspecialty or field of medicine, what would philosophy have to do with it? Is there a philosophy of cardiology? Is there a philosophy of orthopedics? That's part because we know much more about the mechanism of the hip bone connected to the thigh bone, and I can draw you the picture and show you the x-ray, and the mechanics are very straightforward, and we're 100 or 200 years advanced in our knowledge base. But it's also because, in some peculiar way, everybody thinks they're an expert about psychological, behavioral, and addiction health, right? If the cardiologist tells you that you need a stent, you have the impression that there's a technical knowledge base and not everybody knows the latest about stents. But in addiction, everybody's an expert. And so philosophy in our field is something that we have to contend with, right or wrong. There's also the practical issue, which is that when we talk about advances in devices or medications in other medical subspecialties, there is an established medical delivery system embedded at the heart of how patients get care. That isn't so much true in our field. After all, where are the doctors, right? Where are the nurses? Where is that integration of service delivery in which medications can utilize advances? And that's exactly why the MRP is here, to try to see, can we do that kind of integration to do a better job? But there are, you may know, only 3,000 members of the American Society of Addiction Medicine in the whole country. And how many of them live in each of our communities for us to be able to bring that expertise to bear in trying to create this kind of integration? So again, you guys are going to be familiar with this, but again, to give you a language to be able to talk to people who challenge and ask why medications, how does that make sense? People say things like, well, medicines are just a crutch or a band-aid, right? They don't get to the real heart of the issue. Well, maybe they are. But if you break your leg, don't you need a crutch? If you have a boo-boo, don't you need a band-aid? And what about the other ancillary kinds of treatments we use, like group therapy or NA meetings or other things? Are those just crutches or band-aids? So again, we want a broad kind of array of services. And when patients say, no, I'll do it on my own, I finally have the willpower, we say, what about some other tools? Again, even if they are crutches or band-aids, now those are derogatory terms, but okay, fine, let's use them. What about the notion that patients seem to like the medicines too much? This is especially true with the agonists that have intrinsic reinforcing properties like methadone or buprenorphine. Oh my goodness, the patients like the medicine. There must be something wrong with it. Well, okay, but if they don't like it, it doesn't matter how good your treatment is, because if they don't show up for your groups, how effective are your groups going to be? So the notion of creating treatments, whether they be medicine treatments or group treatments or residential treatments or any flavor of treatment you can mention, is not a bad thing. If patients like things, as long as they're good for them, we're probably on the right track. If medications are an easy fix, will patients refuse needed psychosocial treatments and supports? That is, if the medicines fix everything, will they stop coming to groups? Will they stop getting recovery management skills and relapse prevention skills because all they want is the easy fix? Well, as it turns out, in all of the studies that have been done, and in the anecdotal experience of all the providers that I've talked to who do this kind of work, you actually get more behinds in the seats at the psychosocial treatments. And people utilize the other kinds of treatments you're offering, the groups, the psychosocial treatments, the recovery management skills, more if you can prevent relapse and actually get them attending more. So it's not either or, it's both and. If medications eliminate cravings, will patients miss opportunity for needed cravings management? What do I mean by that? One of the things we think that helps people as they're making a transition to sobriety is being able to deal with temptation in the real world. Craving is part of life, and how do you manage it? So if we give patients silver bullets, which by the way we don't have, it's too bad, I wish we did, but if you give patients medicines that take away their cravings, will they get an opportunity to learn to struggle with cravings, which are in fact a reality? Well, if they relapse, that's academic. So giving them the strength and the ability to be able to get some sobriety time and be able to manage temptations in small doses that are not overwhelming is a reality of medication treatment. We do still need to struggle with notions of what's the appropriate duration of medication treatment. Are all medications forever? Some yes, some not. We don't have all the answers. We don't have the long-term data about that the way we wish we do, the way we have in cancer and other medical fields. And maybe we need to figure out a way in which we will talk about phased introduction of medicines followed by tapering and treatment without medicines. We don't know all that technology. Maybe there needs to be a time where we do reintroduce in a desensitization paradigm or a moderated exposure paradigm patients to cravings without taking those away with medicines. But that's a subtlety. The big picture is, if patients relapse, which is what generally happens with psychosocial treatments alone, the idea of this academic notion of exposure to cravings is not a reality. What about abuse and diversion? That is a real issue for some medicines. We know that methadone and buprenorphine, not so much the alcohol medicines I'm going to talk about, but methadone and buprenorphine have a diversion potential. It does need to be managed. I think the media and the scare stories tend to exaggerate it, but we're going to have to be responsible because otherwise the media pundits, you know, will make an example of us and will take this privilege of medication treatment, especially with agonists, away, but I think it's not as big a deal as they make it out to be, and Robert will talk more about this. When you hear about people who use buprenorphine on the streets, they're typically not using it to get high, right? They're typically using it to manage withdrawal symptoms. And so it's not really as scary as the OxyContin, which it replaces, right? So what are some of the things that medicines we hope would do for us? And I'm going to talk now a little bit about, imagine that you're one of those nerdy guys in a white lab coat working in a chemistry lab. And imagine somebody gives you a gazillion bucks in an R&D account and says, build me an addiction pill, build me an addiction medicine. Now, what would you do? What would be some of the things that you would wish for such a medicine if in fact you could conceive that it would happen? So you'd want it to reduce cravings, that would be a good thing, right? You'd want it to impact the physiology of dependence, whatever that is, the withdrawal, the positive reinforcement, the negative reinforcement, the way the brain receptors work and moderate reward. Or you'd want it to protect against lapses, right? Because we know that lapses are a feature of the course of addiction, and the idea that it doesn't work that way is setting ourselves up for failure, right? This old-fashioned notion that people will be struck by a bolt of epiphany lightning and then have sobriety eternally and forever is not really the way most people get recovery, that it's going to be two steps forward, one step back. And so lapses are an opportunity for mediating in some way the effects of any kind of treatment, including medications. Relapse rates are high. We're not always very good about admitting that about our traditional psychosocial treatment. So if we could reduce those rates, that'd be a good thing for a medicine. We could improve retention. And if we could augment in a synergistic way what psychosocial treatment does, not as a replacement, but as an addition to improve what's already strong about current treatments. Well, all of those would be good things if we could invent them. Some of the problems are that medicines might have costs. Although, as Dennis told us this morning, even if you build in the cost of expensive medications to the economic analyses that we are beginning to see, those are overcome by the cost savings. But that's still a barrier because people don't want to pay up front, even if there are long-term savings. Knowledge and training is an issue. I talked a little bit about that. We got a workforce problem. We have prejudice and misunderstanding because these medicines are not necessarily well accepted. There's lack of medical involvement in treatment. I talked about that. There's not a model for where we embed delivery of doctor, nursing, other kinds of services for the most part, because the delivery system in our country has grown up essentially as a non-medical model. Dennis mentioned this. Although our medicines are good, they ain't great. We're at a first and second generation. We'd like to wait for a fifth generation of better potency that would have bigger effect sizes. Although having said that, with medium effect sizes, they've certainly, at least in some contexts, got as much potency as any other tool we have, as any of the psychosocial treatments. So head to head, they're as good as we've got, so that's good, although we do hope for better. They have side effects. There's no medicine that doesn't. Even aspirin, even Tylenol has potential side effects, but these medicines also have them, and that's going to be a barrier. So how could they work? Again, you're the white lab coat guy at a chemistry bench. What could you tinker with? And then we'll compare some of the medicines that we do have and talk about which of these mechanisms they utilize. So one idea is that they could block the mechanism of action of a drug of abuse. So you take a drug of abuse, but because you're protected, it doesn't work, maybe by blocking a receptor. They could reduce the effect of the drug, maybe not block it entirely, but in some way reduce the reward or the reinforcing properties that medicine has, right? Our brains have a built-in reward system. God gave us a chemistry that encourages us to do something more that feels good. Typically, in an evolutionary way, we think of those as behaviors that will improve the survival of the species, but drugs of abuse hijack that. Could we reduce in some way the impact of that reward system? That'd be a good thing. What about withdrawal? Many of the drugs of abuse that we're talking about cause typical withdrawal syndromes when people stop them. That's a way that people are reinforced in their drug use. That's a reason why people use sometimes so as not to be sick. If we could block that, that would be a mechanism. If we could have medicines that act as a non-impairing substitute so that people would choose safer medications over more dangerous drugs. If instead of decreasing reward, we can enhance negative consequences to punish people for drug use, to the extent that that's an effective Skinnerian learning paradigm, could that be an improvement? Could that be a mechanism? And could we prevent relapse from happening even after people are abstinent? So tell me about some of the medicines that you know about that do some of these things. So tell me, who knows a medicine that blocks the effect of action of a particular drug? Which medicine works that way? So naltrexone, either extended release or oral, for what drug of abuse? For opiates, right? So I have a picture of that, right? So God gave us these opiate receptors, right? You guys know all this high school biology. There's an opiate that comes across. And if hand and glove, the way receptors and neurotransmitters work, if you block the opiate receptor, then you can't feel the opiate. And that's how it works for opiates. It's not the way it works for alcohol, right? We'll talk about that in a second. You guys know all this vocabulary, right? An agonist is a turner-oner, an antagonist is a turner-offer, and a partial agonist, antagonist, which Robert's going to talk about when he talks about buprenorphine, is a half-turner-oner, half-turner-offer. What's one that reduces reward? Which medicine works that way? What about naltrexone for alcohol? So naltrexone blocks the opioid receptor, and for opioid abuse, it directly prevents it from working at the receptor. But it doesn't block the alcohol receptor, right? So here's a picture somewhere. Do I have that picture? Okay, here's a picture of how that works. I'm a little out of sort. But it turns out that one of the things that God gave us is a dopamine reward system and an opioid reward system. Presumably, he didn't give us the dopamine reward system so we could be better cocaine agonists. Presumably, he didn't give us the opioid reward system so we could be better cocaine addicts, and he didn't give us the opioid reward system so we could be better heroin addicts. But there are built-in intrinsic rewards at low doses of turner-oner, low doses of dopamine, low doses of the built-in opioid, which is called endorphins, right? So those are things that are naturally occurring all the time. But it also turns out that no one system works in isolation, right? So there are these complex networks in the brain of reinforcement and reward that interact. And this is a cartoon chain of how several of them connect. So in the nucleus accumbens, which is a particular brain region associated with reward in the middle of your brain, it turns out that the mu opioid receptor, with endorphins and enkephalins, another word for the built-in opiate that God gave us, connect with GABA receptors and connect with dopamine receptors. And if it turns out that in the alcohol reinforcement chain, alcohol seems to connect earlier here, turn on opiates, make GABA active, and eventually turn on a dopamine system in the nucleus accumbens, which makes behavior more rewarding, which makes behavior more frequent. And if we can block the chain here upstream, we've diminished the reward from drinking alcohol. So it's not as exact and direct and precise as blocking the activity of opiates the way it works for opiates, but it seems to mediate and reduce reward upstream in a complex chain of different reward pathways for alcohol. What's one that prevents withdrawal? Methadone, that's right. What's another one? Buprenorphine, right? So both of them are agonists or partial agonists, turner-oners or partial turner-oners for opioids. And when people are sick from withdrawal, from acutely stopping the ingestion of the substance, and the brain gets angry and wants more, they act as reducing the craving. I mean, they're reducing withdrawal and reducing the cravings because they are a partial substitute or a substitute at that receptor. What's one that enhances negative consequences? And abuse, right? That's right. So if you drink alcohol on top of it, you're punished by nausea and other sickness, and presumably that changes the operant conditioning paradigm to reduce use. Okay, so, I'm going to order you. So we talked about some of the potentials for how they could work. There are some, these are some of the same things said other ways, so aversive agents, but have you heard of modulators of metabolism? What about that as a mechanism? So let me give you an example. What if there were a drug that could chew up a drug that you ingested, like the liver is supposed to do, but perhaps doesn't do quickly enough, or the kidneys spit it out, but perhaps don't do quickly enough. But what if there was a medication that could get a jump start on that and chew it up before it got you high? Wouldn't that be a neat thing? Well, it turns out that people are currently investigating cocaine hydrolase enzymes that, if they could be developed to work well enough, would chew up cocaine before it got into the brain. What a neat idea. What about immunization? How does immunization work, right? So a virus comes into your body and you've got antibodies, right? And they're the little Pac-Man that gobble up the virus again before it can do the damage, whether that's smallpox or whether that's polio. What if it could do the same thing? What if you could build antibody to cocaine or nicotine? If you could give people inoculating shots in youth, or after they've been identified as addicts, and prevent it from crossing the blood-brain barrier into the brain. Again, science fiction, but it turns out that people are actively developing those kind of strategies, not yet ready for prime time, but what a neat idea. So I just want to give everybody a flavor in that way, and if we have time at the end, we can talk about some more interesting ideas, but I just wanted to give a flavor that there are these interesting biological mechanisms, both for the medicines that we currently have, and for medicines that we might think of in development, and that if you were the mad scientist sitting at the bench, it wouldn't be such a crazy idea to come up with medicines that work in different ways to block the effects, or to modify the effects, or to alter the effects of the drugs themselves, of their metabolism, of their reward, and that people are actively doing this thing, these things in the lab, and that there are scores of such medicines in development, and that the ones we have are already doing some of those things. I'm going to talk about briefly these five as being the current ones that we are currently using actively for alcohol. So we've got oral naltrexone, we've got extended release naltrexone in an injectable form, we've got acamprosate, we've got disulfiram, and those are all FDA approved for the indication of alcohol dependence. And we've got topiramate, which is in some moderately widespread use or increasing use, and it's not FDA approved, but there's still some nice evidence to support. So this just gives you a summary of the FDA approval. Disulfiram has been around for a long, long time, the longest of anything on this list. Naltrexone since 94, acamprosate since 2004, and was widely used in Europe before it was approved in this country, long-acting injectable naltrexone for alcohol since 2006, although more recently, I think in 2010 or 11 for opioids, but more recently, and then topiramate, which remains off-label, but has some mounting evidence for it. So one by one, we already mentioned that disulfiram works as an aversive agent. So the way it works is that it blocks an enzyme called aldehyde dehydrogenase, which is part of the natural breakdown pathway for alcohol in the liver. When you metabolize or break down alcohol, you create something called aldehyde, but the liver then breaks down aldehyde. But aldehyde is relatively poisonous. Aldehyde is broken down by the liver by an enzyme called aldehyde dehydrogenase, and if you take disulfiram, aldehyde dehydrogenase, that liver breakdown enzyme, is rendered impotent, inoperable, doesn't work. So aldehyde builds up. The more you drink, the more aldehyde. And the aldehyde accumulates, and the liver isn't able to break it down. And so you essentially get aldehyde poisoning, which looks like flushing, puking, very sick. People don't like it. And hopefully, that's going to dissuade people through a punishing effect from drinking. But what's the problem with disulfiram? Why has it been largely abandoned for the most part in most clinical practice? Because no one will take it. How come no one will take it? Because no one wants to be sick and puke. Doctor, I could drink, and I know I like that, or I could take your stupid medicine, and I could drink and puke.
Why, are you stupid?
So for the most part, it lies abandoned in medicine chests, right? People write a prescription, here, have a 30-day supply of Antabuse with 6 refills and have a nice life, I hope you never drink, and nobody takes it. However, so it's really been abandoned, and as you say, compliance adherence is really the main barrier. Less than 20%, probably far less than 20% of people will take the pills. Interesting, just a side note, as long as we're talking about compliance and strategies to improve compliance. In general medical practice for chronic illnesses, forget substance abuse for a second, think hypertension, think diabetes, think cholesterol. What do you think average compliance is for people who have to take medicine? By the way, I can't take an antibiotic for 7 days to save my life, okay? But that's not even hard, okay? But I can't do it. But let's talk about real compliance barriers where people are supposed to take medicines for months to years. What do you think the average is? A little better. It's about 1 in 3 pills gets taken. But about 33%, right? 1 in 3 pills. But that's for, you know, average people. I'm not talking about addicts. I'm not talking about people necessarily who have behavioral disorganization. I'm not talking about homeless people. I'm talking about people taking their blood pressure pills. So when I say that less than 20% of people will take Antabuse, that shouldn't be surprising. Maybe it isn't so bad compared to my cholesterol medicine. But in any case, it's been largely abandoned because people won't take it. But it does turn out that in the last decade or so, when people have looked at this in a new kind of way by adding special compliance enhancement procedures, and I'll tell you in a minute what I mean by that, you can actually get a lot of good action out of disulfiram. And Antabuse is actually a great medicine. I use it a fair bit. Other people use it even more than I do. But always in the context, of the lesson we've learned is always in the context not of just, here, have a prescription, take your medicine, and expecting the patients will do it, but with special structured enhancements of compliance. So what kind of things might help? What's a special compliance enhancement? What could you add to Antabuse to get it out of the bottle and into the patient? Anybody have any ideas? How about pay them? Now, I know that's not a medically reimbursable procedure yet. But what about that? So we've got studies in which you can do contingency management or motivational incentives, and you can give people rewards for taking their pills. They tend to take more of them. What else?
A partner.
A partner. So what do you mean by a partner?
Someone who nags you to take your pills.
Although I want to steer you away from the nag word, because nagging doesn't generally improve compliance. Ask my 15-year-old daughter, right? Or ask me when my wife wants me to take the trash out. But the idea is support or encouragement that's done in some kind of more effective way by somebody who you care about and cares about you, right? So Mark Gallanter, who wrote about network therapy, and other people who've done this kind of work, a spouse, a parent, a close friend, a relative, a household member, somebody who monitors, who cares, who checks, even to the point of actually putting the medicine in your mouth, although that's pretty intrusive, but I do that a lot with teenagers and their parents, and can be a very effective way of adding compliance with a special kind of enhancement procedure. But again, it isn't enough just to say, and by the way, have your wife make sure you take it. You gotta rehearse it, you gotta practice it, you gotta check up on it, you gotta have a network in which somebody has a responsibility to call the physician when it doesn't work, you gotta figure out how to avoid confrontation and making it worse by encouraging nagging, all those kinds of things. But it's been studied, it's very effective. What else?
Sometimes you're building, really integrating again a strategy all together. I use it, for example, a lot of interviews, and I explain, you know, impulsive drinking, and you explain, you actually mock the situation where he started to think, I'm going to stop my Antabuse. You know, really working through all those possibilities. So the patient starts to see really the utility, you know, what to do with the temptation. It's almost like a step ahead.
So extra education, good role induction, debriefing and coming back to ask people about how they're doing with their medications. I think those are brilliant techniques, but I have to say, I don't think those are special enhancement techniques. I think those ought to be standard of care for any doctor-patient relationship over any medicine. Now, I know that that may not be the reality, but I think we ought to be doing that every day, all the time, to improve the one out of three pills to better. What else can we do that's special that you wouldn't do for every medication? My colleague, Dr. Kolodner, who runs a very innovative program in the Maryland area called the Colnack Clinic, has developed an interesting procedure with antabuse where he has the alcohol patients in a group do an affirming ritual of taking their antabuse together in group at the same time while they talk about other psychosocial aspects of relapse prevention. So it becomes a ritual. They're all kind of helping each other with the credible partnership of confronting each other. Hey, are you cheeking that medicine? And you know, they can say it better than I can because they're peers. And so it becomes a kind of a ritual. So that's another thing that can be done if you have that kind of group setting. And that's another way, by the way, of making psychosocial treatments synergistic with medicines to improve the effectiveness of both in a reciprocal kind of way. Anyway, there's other things that people have been done, but those kinds of things have been helpful, have reconfirmed the effectiveness of antabuse in real community settings, because before the evidence was only for the lab, but then people wouldn't really take it. But now we know in real community settings, it can be very effective, but only if you add special stuff. In fact, there was one Scandinavian study, I don't remember the author, that showed in a head-to-head comparison of antabuse versus naltrexone versus acamprosate that if you did special enhancement stuff, antabuse actually beat the other two. Hmm. Now, the Scandinavians are funny. I'm not sure if that's right. Okay, great. All right, so let's talk about acamprosate. Brand name is Campryl. It's been around in Europe for a long time, like many things before it was introduced in the States. And how does it work? It's a reward modulator, and naltrexone is a reward module in a different kind of way. It's a reward module on the GABA system, which in turn blocks glutamate, which probably, and we're not sure exactly about the science, but probably works by blocking subacute withdrawal. So when we talk about cravings, we sometimes talk about reward cravings, that is the impetus to want to use drugs of abuse for pleasure. And we also sometimes talk about relief craving, the impetus to want to use drugs of abuse, not necessarily to get pleasure, but to reduce displeasure. Both are important. Different patients have one versus the other. Many have both, right? But that's very important to acknowledge. This probably works on the relief craving side. That is taking away the pain or the discomfort of withdrawal. But what other kind of discomfort is there that people use drugs for?
Sleeplessness, anxiety.
Yeah, right. How about anxiety? How about depression and other negative affects? How about just the discomfort of life its own self when it's not going well, right? Some people have developed coping skills over time in which they don't have their own built-in stress reduction mechanisms, their own pro-social coping, but they use drugs of abuse. And so relief craving is one of the things that propels and reinforces drug use, and it looks like acamprosate works on that mechanism for alcohol. Looks like it works better when it's initiated after abstinence, so we don't generally think about giving acamprosate to active drinkers. There are lots of people who are doing that, though, and there's probably some effectiveness, but it looks like the effectiveness is increased when used after a period of abstinence. It looks like it works better in very high severity alcoholics, those that have had withdrawal and other kinds of severe, longer term, longer duration of drinking consequences. You may have heard that there's some controversy in the literature between the European studies and the American studies. The American studies that have been done more recently here have not shown the same kind of effectiveness that the European studies are. And one theory about that is that we're much more restrictive about how sick you can be and still be in a study. The Europeans are less restrictive about that. And so much more end-stage kinds of alcoholics with severe withdrawal symptoms have been in European studies where it seems to be more effective. And we tend to recruit much healthier patients into our studies in which it's not been as clearly demonstrated. But it's still in widespread use and should be solidly in the armamentarium. Not only does lead-in abstinence benefit its effectiveness, but there seems to be a synergy with motivation. Patients that are motivated seems to have a higher benefit for Campryl. The way it's dosed is a bit of a problem. So it's a 3 times a day medicine. And remember, 3 times a day antibiotic for 7 days, I can't even take. Imagine getting people to take a medicine 3 times a day for months and years. That's a big barrier. And people say they're taking their noontime dose, but mostly they're not. The problem is, if you need to get in this kind of standard dose of 666 milligrams three times a day, if you divide it into one time a day or two times a day to get the minimum effective dose into people, there's a limiting side effect of diarrhea, which is very unpleasant for people, and then they tend to drop off. So compliance, again, is an issue here, but for patients who will take it, or for patients for whom taking it twice a day is effective, and that's not everybody, it's still a very useful medicine. And it seems like it's gotten more of a foothold in Europe than it has here, but I still encourage people to use it and use it a lot. And again, as I'll talk a little bit in a second about how to compare with naltrexone. So naltrexone, which used to be brand named Revia, I don't know if that manufacturer still brands it that anymore. Does anybody know? Yeah, I don't know, but anyway, oral naltrexone. And as I said before, it blocks the opioid reward system cascade for alcohol. So although some patients will say things like, won't I get sick if I drink on naltrexone? That's not true. It's important to remind them that it's not going to make you sick. But what we hope will happen is that over time, you'll be less rewarded by alcohol. You can still get drunk. You can still feel the martini at a cocktail party or the Thunderbird when you're on the corner. But over time, the typical experience is that people will not get as much pleasure, will not seem as motivated to continue drinking at the pace they have, in a slow, gradual kind of way. Do not expect this to be an overnight cure. People will not take it and suddenly not drink. You will just see a gradual diminution over time. It looks like lead-in abstinence is helpful but not necessary, so people give it both with active drinkers and with people who have undergone some kind of detox or discontinuation, but it definitely works better in those that have had lead-in abstinence. Motivation for abstinence does not seem to influence the outcome the way it does with acamprosate, so in some ways that's an advantage. You don't have to want to stop drinking to just insidiously decrease or stop your drinking. It seems to work anyway. And the kinds of outcomes that have been measured in most of the studies are not so much full abstinence, but rather decreasing total drinking days, so gradually cutting down, and even more impressively, decreasing heavy drinking days. So patients may find that they're still drinking, but they're not having the 10 drink binges that they used to have. Heavy drinking in research is typically defined as 5 or more alcoholic beverages in one sitting, for a man, 4 for a woman, and that's a kind of a nice threshold for what's likely to be a problematic drinking episode. And as I'll show you in a second, all of the data with naltrexone and extended-release naltrexone for alcohol shows a very clear and convincing reduction in that kind of binge or heavy drinking pattern. The routine, it comes in 50 milligram pills. When it was first introduced, everybody was given 50 milligrams a day. In general practice, we've increased that dosing now, so I and others routinely are giving 100 milligrams a day, and 150 milligrams a day is a nice way of compensating for non-compliance with the pill, because as we said, most people only take 1 out of 3 pills. The nice thing about this medicine is if you give 150 milligrams and then they skip a day or two, you've still got medicine on board, and that's a relatively safe thing to do. Some of the side effects that people report include fatigue, a little dizziness, a little appetite suppression, some GI or tummy stuff. Most of that goes away. Most people tolerate this very well. It's very typical in a first week for people to describe this kind of fatigue malaise. We sometimes call that the naltrexone flu. Kind of a flu-like, non-specific, I don't feel quite right, but almost universally it goes away. And there are perhaps 1% or so, certainly under 5% of people, who just don't like it and feel unwell in an enduring way, but 95% plus people do fine with it. There had been some early concerns about liver risk, but as that's been studied over time with more time on the market, that's really not such a big deal. Even for patients that have concurrent alcohol liver disease, when you compare what's worse for your liver, alcohol or naltrexone, I'll take naltrexone every day. And as that's been studied, looking at markers of liver inflammation, they always go down because people's drinking is going down. And so the negative profile that is, I think, a falsely earned reputation, and it's relatively safe in all but the most severe liver disease patients. Here's just a graph. This is from one of the first studies of oral naltrexone, one of the pioneering studies by Volpicelli. But it shows you the placebo versus naltrexone. This is a survival curve with the percentage of patients out here at 12 weeks who have not relapsed to heavy drinking. So this is not any drinks. This is five or more drinks in an episode. That's a fairly persuasive number, right? 80%+ of people compared to 35% of people on placebo. And this has been replicated again and again and again. Now, one of the things it does require is getting your head around this notion that we're not going to be looking for enduring eternal abstinence and capital R recovery as our outcome. We're going to be saying that it is going to be an acceptable and celebrated outcome to look at the reduction of impairing heavy drinking as a step along the way to the gold standard of enduring abstinence and capital R recovery. But that's an outcome that's associated with reduced costs, improvement in psychosocial function, and reduction in medical and psychiatric morbidity. So we still think that that's an important outcome. So why one versus the other? Naltrexone is probably more active on the reward craving side. So patients that talk about the energizing or marvelous, wonderful feeling they get with alcohol, as opposed to a camphorsate that might be speculatively more effective on the patients that talk about the icky feeling they have when they don't drink. Again, that's subtle, that's hard to quantify, we're not sure if that's true, but that's one of the kind of emerging clinical anecdotal approaches. Are you talking about more action on the relief craving side or more action on the reward craving side? There's also data about some populations that might have more response to naltrexone having to do with what we think are genetic risks. And I don't have time to show you some very, very interesting data about actually getting into the genome and doing gene testing for who might be a candidate. But barring that, a couple of clinical pearls about who's a good candidate for naltrexone that probably gives us a hint of genetic vulnerability. Patients that have first-degree relatives with severe alcoholism are probably good candidates for naltrexone. And patients that talk about an energizing effect of alcohol as opposed to a sedative effect of alcohol, right? Because some people have two drinks and fall asleep. There's some people who have two drinks and get more revved up. Describing that revved up subjective feeling is probably, not 100%, but is probably correlated with a positive naltrexone response. There are some people who have investigated and have some preliminary evidence for an improved effect of combination therapy with the two medicines together, although a major study called the combined study was not able to find evidence of that. So the jury's still out on that. But if you think by analogy, sometimes when one statin isn't enough for your cholesterol, we go to two. Sometimes when one antibiotic is not enough for your infection, we go to two. The analogy is that if one medicine by one mechanism gives you partial improvement, could another medicine adding another biological mechanism give you an additive or even more a synergistic multiplicative effect? And that would be certainly very welcome, although we don't have the evidence. So deponaltrexone, or extended release naltrexone, I'll finish up, is an advance over oral naltrexone in that it improves compliance, right? Because it's a once a month injection, lasts about 30 days. And so you don't have to torture yourself with the day-by-day decision of take the pill, don't take the pill. And so you overcome that one in three pills compliance issue. You still have to take the second shot 30 days later. So it's by no means a silver bullet. It's by no means a perfect answer to compliance. But 30 days is still a nice chunk of time. And so the initial evidence is that it's at least as good as oral naltrexone, and most of the converging data suggests that it's an improvement on oral naltrexone because people will have more of the drug in them rather than remaining in the bottle in the medicine cabinet. And what we're hoping for, right, is that there's big market penetration and that it gets picked up, because the more any of these medicines succeed, and it looks like so far of all of them, Vivitrol has the biggest chance of doing that, but to the extent that any of them succeed, that's more of an investment in the future pipeline, so that Big Pharma will invest in the next best thing if they think they can make a squillion bucks for their stockholders. So we're certainly watching and waiting and hoping. And then Robert will talk about its additional use for opioids. Lastly, topiramate, which is brand name Topamax. Its original use and its main use is an anti-seizure medicine and secondarily as an anti-migraine medicine. It's a very good anti-migraine medicine. Turns out that led by Bancoldi Johnson and other people, there's been investigation of its use as a reward mediator in some ways similar to the mechanism of a Camprasate, but using it for reducing alcohol cravings. One of the nice things about topiramate is that it seems to be just as effective when starting it in actively drinking patients. So remember I told you that the Camprasate looks much better after lead in abstinence. Now Trexone looks somewhat better after lead in abstinence. Topiramate, it makes no difference. Start it when they're actively drinking and you get the same effect as if you start it after detox or after they've stopped. So that's a plus. Its side effect profile is concerning to some people. We sometimes call it the stupid drug. A lot of people who take it for migraines and seizures find that they have difficulties in concentration and thinking, so that's a barrier for some people. But not everybody, that's only about 15 or 20% of people. About half of the people who take it get some kind of weird sensations, tingling kind of feelings, and some change in their perception of taste. They say food tastes a little bit different. But those aren't usually deal breakers for people, and most people can take it, and it looks like it's a reasonable alternative to the other three. The FDA hasn't yet approved it. I'm not sure if the drug company is ever going to invest the money in trying to get an indication. But I think it should be solidly on the list of, if not first line, at least second line for when patients aren't going to take the other things, or maybe even to add it to the other things, in particularly refractory patients who are struggling. This is an interesting, well, maybe I'll stop. I'm running out of time. I'm going to not show you more data. It's in the book. Maybe some questions and some discussions in the last 2 minutes.
Your opinion about gabapentin?
Gabapentin for alcohol.
There's some like anecdotal stuff there.
What's that?
There is some anecdotal.
Some anecdotal stuff. I think that there's not enough evidence to warrant it as superseding any of these other things. Gabapentin, as some of you might know, is a brand name Neurontin. There are some early studies looking at it. It probably shares some of the GABA neurotransmission mechanisms of a Camprasate and topiramate. It has less side effects, so people are eager to use something that's easier to take. But caution, we made that mistake for a decade about gabapentin for bipolar disorder, and everybody got really excited. It's easier to take than lithium. There's only one problem. It don't work. Oops. So careful on that. I reserve judgment on gabapentin, but it's encouraging. Yeah. All right, so real quick. All right, this is the genetic people. All right, so here we go. So some existing medicines that are out there, but we should turn to other uses. Extended release naltrexone for opioids, it's already an old story. I made this slide before it was FDA approved, so Robert will tell you that that's not the future, that's now, and we're already using it. There's an anti-epilepsy medicine called vigabatrin. Again, vigabatrin, so it's in the same neurotransmitter classes. We're talking about gabapentin and acamprosate and topiramate. Looks like it modulates cravings for cocaine. It has difficulties because it's got toxic vision side effects, so it's not yet ready for prime time and isn't yet going to be the great big thing that everybody's going to rush out and want to buy. But we've been searching for 3 decades for a cocaine medicine and have been striking out repeatedly. So anything that we can find that really has evidence of modulating reward for cocaine would be a good thing. So stay tuned on that. It and its cousins might turn out to be okay. It turns out that Vivitrol is actually probably going to be very effective for stimulants, cocaine and methamphetamine. And there's evidence both in this country and in Scandinavia, big trials going on in looking at Vivitrol for cocaine, Vivitrol for methamphetamine. So stay tuned for that. There's a medicine called pregabalin, back to the GABA neurotransmission. Its brand name is Lyrica. We don't have any medicines currently for benzos, but it might be that Lyrica pregabalin has some benefit as a substitute for benzos. Disulfiram, antabuse, which we talked about for alcohol, actually has some mild to moderate anti-craving effect for cocaine. Totally different mechanism, doesn't make you sick when you take cocaine, but it turns out that it also blocks an enzyme that decomposes dopamine. So we think that it partially works by raising your dopamine levels in such a way that perhaps you don't have as much need for cocaine as a dopamine booster. We don't know. Guess what part of the problem is with giving people disulfiram for cocaine is? Why won't they take it? They want a drink! I swear, Doc, it was an accident. I didn't mean to drink. But I got sick, and so now I'm not going to take it. But anyway, they're coming up, though, are going to be medicines that do what disulfiram does for dopamine without having the side effect of doing what it does for alcohol. As far as I'm concerned, that's not a side effect. That's a double whammy for my alcohol plus cocaine patients. I want both effects. But the patients may not agree with me. So if I could isolate the dopamine effect and give that to a patient, and they could still accidentally drink without getting sick, that might be a compliance enhancement. So stay tuned for a medicine in phase two called Napicastat, which does that. We'll see if that turns out to be any good. Buspirone, brand name Buspar, an old-fashioned anti-anxiety medicine that probably doesn't work that great for anxiety anyway, may have interesting properties for cocaine. So there's trials ongoing now to look at that. Very strong animal models. Very strong animal laboratory evidence. We don't yet have the human evidence. What about some science fiction? Remember I was talking about immune responses. What if you could build a vaccine against cocaine and nicotine? Well, it turns out that it's been done. Neither the cocaine vaccine nor the nicotine vaccine are ready for prime time. Neither work that great. None of them capture enough of the population. I mean, just to give you a cartoon idea, 20% of the people that you give the cocaine vaccine to get enough antibody on board to reduce their cocaine use after 5 shots for a duration of 3 months. All right, don't buy stock yet. But as proof of concept, the idea that you could build an immune response intervention. And yeah, we got to improve the technology. We got to get it from 5 shots to 1 shot. We got to get 20% to 80%. Fine. But at least it's conceptually conceivable now that we could get there. What a neat idea. Implant naltrexone. So instead of a 30-day shot, what about a 3-month pellet that you put in your arm? Implant buprenorphine. Instead of a once-a-day pill, what about an implant that lasts for 60 days? Coming to a drugstore near you. Probufene will probably be FDA approved within 2 years. What a neat idea. Not for everybody, because once you put it in, it's not trivial to take it out. But for the patients that you want buprenorphine for and they struggle with compliance, that would be one approach to overcoming the compliance barrier. Cannabinoid antagonists, right? So just like God gave us built-in opiate receptors, he gave us built-in cannabis or cannabinoid receptors and built-in neurotransmitters that fit hand in glove. Again, probably not so we could be better marijuana addicts, but because it does interesting things having to do with reward, with pain, with anxiety. And if you could block that receptor, would that be a potential response to marijuana addiction? Well, it turns out we were this close to having a cannabinoid antagonist on the market. And what do you think the drug company was hoping to make $1 squillion on? Marijuana addiction? No. Try to think of another thing that if you block the marijuana receptor or the cannabinoid receptor that you could make $1 million on, a gazillion dollars on. What's a side effect of marijuana that you'd like to block? How about the munchies? So what about a diet pill by blocking built-in cannabinoid activity? So it was a big deal. Everybody was all ready for it. It was actually on the market briefly in Europe, but never made it to the market in the States, because it had a difficult side effect that ended up not being a good idea, depression and other kinds of things. But just because the first one didn't hit doesn't mean we won't build a better mousetrap and find a cannabinoid antagonist that's better than that without those side effects. Metabolic enzymes I talked about, so the idea of a cocaine breaker-downer product that would work fast, again, only available in animal models, but to be able to build that in humans. And then there's this whole interesting field, and I'll stop now because we don't have time, but lots of patients get abstinence for a short time or a long time, but then relapse because of what? because of stress or triggers that come not as a result necessarily of their first or previous episodes of addiction and trouble, but because of future difficulty in mediating environmental conflict. What if we could figure out the biological mechanism of stress-induced relapse and make people less vulnerable to going back to old behaviors as a substitute coping mechanism for stress? And it turns out that there are some very interesting biological models and drugs, at least in animal discovery systems, in blocking the NK1 and other neurotransmitter systems that look like they can do that. Way cool, right? Anyway, there's the science fiction glimpse, but I think that it's exciting to think that all these mad scientists at their bench have the possibility of a palette of new things, and as Dennis says, if we can figure out how to develop infrastructure and delivery models for bringing in the B pluses now, imagine when we get the A minuses, A's, and A pluses in the future. So we certainly await that topic. Good. And we're out of quiz.